Welcome to the New Books Network.
Rastafarianism is a topic I have never discussed on the show, though I've meant to, for several years at this point. The story of Haile Selassie, Jamaica, Ethiopia, and Shashamani are deeply interesting. Like many, I found out about Rastafarianism through the music of Bob Marley and the Bad Brains as a teenager, but I never took it any deeper until years later when my students were interested in learning more about the topic. I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Aaron McLeod to the show. Dr. McLeod is the author of Visions of Zion, Ethiopians and Rastafari in the Search for the Promised Land, released by NYU Press in 2014. In this episode, we discuss travels in Ethiopia, the history of the Rastafarian movement and how it is perceived by the Ethiopian people, and what has happened in the years since the book was released. You can find Dr. Aaron McLeod at aaronmcleod.ca. That's M-A-C-L-E-O-D. Please enjoy our conversation on Visions of Zion. Dr. Aaron McLeod, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
I'm delighted to have you on the show. And I'm wondering if you can just spend a moment and introduce yourself to our listeners, however you see fit, for just a moment.
Well, I am a teacher, writer, researcher. I always sort of put et cetera on the end of that because I no longer work directly in the world of academia, even though I was involved in academia for a long time, by which I mean university level academia. I teach at a college in Quebec in this system that we refer to as CEGEP, which is an educational college for general and professional purposes. Normally, when I speak to people outside of Quebec, I say it's kind of like a last couple of years of high school and community college combined together in one building. The focus is really on teaching, and I teach literature and composition. So really trying to encourage critical thinking as well as effective communication in English amongst my students, who are probably 18 to 21. And then I also have a business where I do consulting for NGOs, really strictly about reporting to government funders, particularly the Canadian government. And then I also do some journalism. I've written for the New York Times, the Globe and Mail, the Guardian in the UK, Rolling Stone, on music primarily, but also on culture as well. So I do a bunch of different things, but one of those things that I tend not to do as much of anymore is academia. So thank you for having me on the show as kind of a ex-academic and not a current scholar, as it were.
Love it. Well, I'm also somebody who jumped ship from higher education. I was in a PhD program for a couple of years, which I've talked about on the show before, and jumped ship right before comprehensive exams because I realized that that was not for me. Mm-hmm. And I was traveling down a path that I kind of had to take some hard looks and realize, like, this isn't really for me. Do you have any, like, you know, thoughts on, like, what it was that made you jump ship from that world?
Well, I mean, normally I'm someone who is sometimes to my detriment, not a quitter, as my parents might have described it. So I kept going with the PhD to finish it. Like, yeah. That was my goal, was to finish it, but really unsure as to what would come after that. I'm kind of a completist. I'm a completist with TV shows, books, as well as apparently my PhD program. So when I left When I completed the PhD, I did apply for many, many jobs, but it became clear that it just was not in the cards. Mm-hmm. And after almost a decade of applying for jobs and having some interviews and that kind of thing, I had a final campus visit interview in 2018. And that was about 9.5 years of trying, and I did not get that job. And so obviously I was very upset, and I made the decision to take a step away. But during all of this time, I'm very lucky. I mean, I did still have the job with the SAGEP, and kind of trying to create other possibilities. And I still attended conferences, had wonderful conversations with lots of wonderful people, and kept publishing work. But being a professor at a research institution just didn't pan out.
Yeah, I love hearing stories like that, because the life path that people have taken within academia is really interesting to me. It's always interesting to me to hear people stories of people who have left, the stories of people who have stayed, the stories of people who have stayed and disliked it the whole time. Those are interesting to me as well. So, you know, the reason you're here today is you put out a book several years ago with NYU Press called Visions of Zion, Ethiopians and Rastafari in the Search for the Promised Land. And I'm really interested. I found this book through you and I connected through other ways, but I'm really interested in your academic trajectory and a little bit of the story of how you came to be interested in the Rastafarian movement and Ethiopia in general. And I'd love to just kind of hear a little bit of your story there.
Sure. I mean, I suppose, and I did tell this story when I did my thesis defense, actually. I come from a family of Irish and Scottish migrants to North America. And I first got into Irish literature. I was a literature scholar, and I got into Irish literature, and I was really interested in the work of Irish writers who basically were trying to write themselves and their own culture into existence in the face of British colonialism, which led me to read all sorts of different so-called post-colonial literature in graduate school, because my master's degree was in literature, and then I moved into sort of more communications and cultural studies in my PhD. And, whereas the Irish literature was personally inspirational to me, when I got into other forms of literature that were writing against sort of oppressive colonial structures and the legacy of what is a heinous system that continues to this day, I just found book after book after book that I absolutely, absolutely adored. And then I had the opportunity with a Canadian organization called CUSO International, which the best way to refer to it is kind of like the Canadian version of the Peace Corps, although not quite so structured. I had the opportunity to go and work at the University of the West Indies and to support a communications initiative. It was the Disaster Information Network, sort of spreading information about disaster preparation and disaster response amongst countries within the Caribbean. And because I took a diploma in communications after my master's degree in literature, this is why I applied for this program and then ended up in Kingston, Jamaica, working at the university and working at the library. And in that job, I had access to the rare book section, which when I came back years later, almost a decade later as a postdoctoral fellow, I never had the same access again. So it was kind of wonderful. And I could go in and look at all of the rare books. And they have some amazing, amazing things at the University of the West Indies. You know, Derek Walcott's original manuscripts seated right next to these these piles and piles of records of enslaved individuals. And so it really is quite stark, the types of material and the history that is held there. And that is where I came into contact with books and information around Rastafari. And, you know, thinking about all of these different ways that, you know, cultures around the world have fought back against colonialism, you know, Rastafari took the colonial religion and transformed it in the image of Rastafari and the image of blackness. And that to me was tremendously powerful. And then to learn that, you know, this also shifted identities so that Rastafari identifies being Ethiopian, and then they repatriate to Ethiopia in a community about 250 kilometers south of Addis Ababa, seeing themselves as Rastafari, as Ethiopian, and then the wondering myself, what is the reaction to that? And as someone who has lived most of their lives in Quebec and has witnessed, and I mean, I don't know when you are going to air this or how much information people have about recent happenings this year in Quebec, but with the passing of Bill 96, which is a new language law, which makes many, many demands on people in Quebec with regards to French language, one of which is in the first 6 months of arrival, immigrants must learn French, and after those 6 months have no access to government documentation or any communication with the government in any language other than French. So, and this has been in the works for some time. So the dynamics around that and the dynamics around how host communities engage with incoming populations, and this whole sort of sense that it is the responsibility of the incoming population to adapt to the host community's so-called values and culture, all of this kind of came together to make me really interested in that dynamic between Rastafari and Ethiopia, and how that might allow for a greater understanding of some of the tensions in negotiations with regards to sort of anti-colonial thinking, so-called post-colonial thinking, migration, transnational communities, notions of citizenship, notions of identity, what does it mean to be a citizen of a space, et cetera, et cetera. All of this stuff has been of interest to me just from my experience as a sort of settler Canadian, a Canadian with a settler background, and thinking about how this functions in Canada and how there is very little recognition of the different sites around the world that reflect some of the same issues. It's always kind of, well, only look at the West. What the West is cosmopolitan, but anywhere else is not. When in reality, there's a great deal of elements that are significantly instructive when you look in other spaces, but colonialism has led us to really sort of feel that there is one space, and that is this so-called Western world.
I love this. Well, I'm excited to hear some travel stories as well too, but let's like kind of bring the book in here. Visions of Zion, Ethiopians and Rastafari in the Search for the Promised Land from NYU. So 8 years have passed since the release of this book, which I realize is kind of maybe an interesting revisiting, or, you know, maybe, you know, you're digging up some memories and things like that to talk about this book. And I'm wondering what you most remember about your time surrounding the research and release of this book, and like where you were at the time, and, you know, just some thoughts on the context of, you know, you in Ethiopia learning these things for yourself. Tell me about take me back in time a little bit.
Well, I first went to Ethiopia after returning from Jamaica in 2003. Mm-hmm. If my dates are slightly incorrect, I apologize.
It's okay. Ago.
So I came back from Jamaica in 2003, and then I had the opportunity to work with Habitat for Humanity. And Habitat for Humanity has this program called the Global Village Program. Now, a lot of people assume that the Global Village Program, you sort of, it's a bunch of white people that go over to another country, build something and leave. When in reality, it's a very small, I think it's less than 10% of their work. And local Habitat for Humanity offices around the world, and also in different parts of Canada, North America, et cetera, they will ask for fundraising reasons to support a group of people to come over and work, engage in what Habitat for Humanity refers to as sweat equity, in solidarity with a community in another part of the country or another part of the world. Mm-hmm. And also kind of supporting local tourism, local businesses in doing that. So I was involved in leading a group to Ethiopia. That was the country that there was the most requests from local Habitat for Humanity volunteer-led offices in Ethiopia. And so I led a group of American folks, a team, and we went over for 2 weeks and mostly observed, assisted in kind of what I would refer to as some very basic unskilled manual labor. Mm-hmm. learned about their programming and had a amazing time. And that is when I decided, hey, you know, I would really be interested in learning more about Ethiopia. I mean, Ethiopia is a remarkable place, and it's for all sorts of historical, cultural, geographic, food reasons. And I figured out that I could return to Ethiopia if I kept working with Habitat. I initially was a team member, and then I trained to be a team leader to be involved in this program. And then that led me to think, well, maybe I should apply to go back to school to look into this, because the first time I was there, I spent an extra couple of weeks in the country. And because of my experience in Jamaica, I then went to this town called Shashamani, which is where there is a Rastafari settlement due to land that was provided to, Haile Selassie stated it was for the Black people of the world. That he bequeathed as a thank you for the support that had been received from the wider Pan-African community during the Italian occupation. Mm. And so this piece of land, not very many people initially took him up on the offer. And a work that is really key for understanding the land grant and the history of the land grant is Giulia Bonacci's Exodus. She's an Italian French scholar, historian who has tracked the development of this space since the land grant itself, how it's changed over time and over the changes in Ethiopia's history. So those experiences with Habitat really kind of led me to apply to do a PhD part-time while I was still working full-time. That's the other thing about me is I was never fully dedicated to the PhD. I was always working as well as doing the PhD. So I would have to do it kind of piecemeal. It took me a little while. It took me about 6 years to finish it. But It was really through those initial kind of experiences in Jamaica, experience in Ethiopia, that sort of led to an application to do a PhD program. I applied to one program. I applied to McGill in Montreal, and that's how I kind of started in on the work. And eventually, after 6 years and 13 trips back and forth to Ethiopia, most of them via Habitat, then a couple as a result of a research grant from the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, I interviewed over 100 people, talked about their view on Rastafari. Mm-hmm. So I was really looking at, you know, the Ethiopian perception of the Rastafari community in Ethiopia. And this was in this town of Shashamani, where there is this settlement, as well as kind of more broadly in terms of an analysis of the media. You know, how is Rastafari treated in the media in Ethiopia? And so speaking to various journalists, as well as scholars, Ethiopian scholars who had studied Rastafari, and all of this kind of question, and sorry, I mean, I'm kind of talking around this a little bit, but it was really like the kind of, I guess, the catalyst for all of the research to happen was I was sitting with a dear friend, one of my closest friends in this whole world. His name is Heroi Arif Aine. He's an amazing person, lives in Addis Ababa, used to organize the Ethiopian Music Festival. Fantastic human being. And I asked him, as I was kind of thinking about all of this stuff before I'd applied to do a PhD, I said, hey, you know, this is really interesting, like Rastafari coming to Ethiopia, identifying as Ethiopian, living in Shashamani, from and Rastafari coming from all sorts of different places around the world. I mean, what do Ethiopians think about this? Mm-hmm. And he turned and said to me, he's like, well, nobody ever asks us. And I thought, well, that's my PhD project. I'm just gonna ask. I am neither Rastafari nor am I Ethiopian. I'm interested in that kind of intercultural communicative moment, I guess you could say, of two cultures coming together, having grown up in a space with you know, the so-called two solitudes of French and English, and observing all of the language tensions and how that functioned, and having no real understanding of how to negotiate that effectively in many situations, that this kind of offered an opportunity to say, okay, well, in what is happening in this site where you have different cultures coming together, sharing the same space, identifying as being Ethiopian, much like in Canada, we, you know, whether you speak French or you speak English or any other language, there is this identity of Canadian. And so kind of being interested in how these notions and nations and identities function.
Yeah, the story like that you put in the introduction of the book about sitting on the bus and there's being near Shashamani, and mm-hmm. having a realization, a conversation with a woman where she saw you as much Ethiopian as she saw these people who were going to Shashamani and are Rastafarian. Mm-hmm. And there's like this, I found that the identity of Ethiopianness and Rastafari as really interesting. And, you know, does that make sense? Am I kind of on the right track here?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, I mean, the concept of Ethiopia and Ethiopianness is highly fraught. And I wrote this book, you know, most of the research occurred between 2004 and 2012, mm-hmm. let's say. So that period, we're now, you know, a decade out of that. We've had numerous changes in governments in Ethiopia. Presently, there is what can only be referred to as a civil war in Ethiopia, and you have seriously competing narratives about what is happening in Ethiopia. And I won't go too much into that. I'll stick to my own expertise of the period when sure. I was in Ethiopia. But this idea of the competing narratives of what it means to be Ethiopian, and from the Ethiopian perspective, and this feeds into the reality that we see today, there's a multiplicity. And, you know, not only are there, I mean, there's the famous 84 different ethnic groups speaking as many languages in Ethiopia, and probably more than that number, depending on how you wish to count ethnicities and languages and dialects, etc. And then you have the Rastafari, who really have a comprehensive, cohesive understanding of what Ethiopia means to Rastafari. Mm-hmm. And that stems from an understanding of an Ethiopia that is in the past. You know, and in the book, I talk about the different maps. You know, I could have a map of a certain space, and you could have a map of the certain space, and they could look completely different because they're informed by different cultural, historical, socioeconomic, racial, ethnic, religious realities. So we are in the same space, but we're seeing it in completely different ways. And this mm-hmm. is the situation with Rastafari and Ethiopia. And so this idea of Ethiopianness, this idea of what it means to be Ethiopian for Rastafari, is very different than what is faced in the reality of Ethiopia, because they're relying on kind of maps and understandings, and quite literally maps, because we're talking about a land grant, right? Maps and understandings under a emperor who is no longer in power in Ethiopia. And so that really causes some issues. And then you have to look at the space that is Shashamani, which is a incredibly multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious space with significant tensions of its own, one of which, as someone who spent most of their lives in Quebec, is very familiar to me, to see the language issues where, you know, Amharic and Afan Oromo, so Amarinya and Omarinya, are kind of in conflict. You would see signs that had been in Amharic painted over with Afan Oromo writing. So the different alphabets, and learning obviously about how under Haile Selassie there was a deep sense of Amharization of the country, and having a lingua franca and putting that in place and enforcing that in the school. Also very familiar to someone mm-hmm. who is from Quebec, and the constitutional history of Ethiopia, where there is a written into the constitution is the ability to for different areas of the country to separate, different regions to separate. Again, it has a resonance when you're thinking about these kinds of issues here in Canada.
Amazing. Well, let's dive into a little bit about Rastafari, because I've never talked about Rastafari on this show before, and I'm really curious about this concept of Zion within Ethiopia, and like any major things about Rastafari that listeners of this show who don't know much about the beliefs of Rastafari, what do you think are some like basics that people should definitely know?
I think the basic thing is to know that Rastafari is a movement that was not developed within the space that is Ethiopia. Rastafari came to be, it was a bit of a perfect storm of the early part of the 20th century, whereby you have colonialism that's kind of fighting to maintain a stranglehold, especially British colonialism in the English-speaking Caribbean. There are different movements, different leaders who are speaking out against British colonialism, like from a religious perspective, Alexander Bedward. You also have, obviously, Marcus Garvey, Leonard Howell. You have a range of different individuals who are speaking out against the oppressive nature of British colonialism in Jamaica. And this is also coming at a time when Haile Selassie comes to power in Ethiopia. You know, so these different, again, these narratives then end up being in communication with each other. And because, you know, Jamaica is a religious space informed by Christianity, reading the Bible in the face of these different forces led to an interpretation that Haile Selassie represented, you know, there is a king who will rise in the east and it will herald a new day for Africa. This idea that the as Alexander Bedwood said, you know, there is a black wall and the white wall, and, you know, the white wall is trying to take over the black wall, but the black wall will, you know, will rise. Marcus, you know, the problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line. You have these different, this discourse that's happening and these events that are happening. And Haile Selassie presented, in the face of British colonialism, which presents its own monarch, an option. And a political option, a monarchical option, a spiritual option, being the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the conquering line of the tribe of Judah, you know, this all came together to support a movement in Jamaica that then found a voice amongst people who were struggling to survive, find work in the city of Kingston, Jamaica at that time. We're talking in the 1930s, and then continuing on to support the independence movement in Jamaica, leading to independence in 1962, mm-hmm. which is, what are we looking at, 60 years ago come this August.
Yeah.
So, you know, Rastafari was a tremendously important and remains a tremendously important movement in Jamaica and the rest of the world. And then obviously through the mechanism of reggae and fundamentally the voice of Bob Marley, basically extending to every corner of the earth. Although oftentimes without a particularly full understanding of some of the tenets of the movement, which I think you're asking about, which would be, for instance, repatriation.
Yeah.
As one, reparations as another, the idea of dreadlocks and of ganja as sacrament. That varies between different groups of Rastafari. There are different mansions of Rastafari. I won't go into all of them, but there are a number, and they do have significant differences in terms of leadership, in terms of certain types of beliefs. But Black man redemption is another main tenet of Rastafari. And I would say it's definitely an anti-colonial movement as well. But again, the I had the privilege and opportunity to be involved in guest editing an issue of Ideas, which is a journal out of the University of the West Indies, and an Arawak Press. And it was really kind of looking at shifts in the movement over time. So it does change, and it is a movement that is quite flexible, and in some ways controversial because of the relatively recent inclusion of whites and other non-Black peoples. And so there are sort of questions have been raised about how Rastafari can maintain some of the tenets, like a focus on fighting anti-Blackness and supporting Black redemption and repatriation and reparations when white folks are involved.
Well, I know that you've also recently revisited some of the things within the conclusion of the book. So the conclusion is called The Future of Ethiopians and Rastafari in the Promised Land. And like I mentioned earlier, 8 years have passed since the book was released. And I want to know about this revisiting that you've done, and if there are any updates to what you foresaw as the future that you describe in the conclusion. Tell me about revisiting this and what you've done recently.
What I did recently, because when the book ended, at the time, there had Meles Zenawi, the former leader of Ethiopia, had passed away quite suddenly, and there had been Rastafari that I had been in contact with who stated that they had been in contact with the government at that time to discuss ways and means of integration into Ethiopia from a sort of a political and legal perspective. Most of my, during the time of my research, however, Rastafari were not citizens, but the Rastafari living in Shashamani were living under, let's say, what is the term for it? It was not regularized. It was, sure. It was a very kind of informal situation. Many people having visas that had long been invalidated, I guess you'd say, to the extent that should someone wish to leave, it would be cost prohibitive to try to pay any of the penalties for overstaying your visa, etc. There were very few people who had been able to achieve some level of residence permit. This had issues in terms of land ownership, because only nations, nationalities, and peoples of Ethiopia are able to own land. There are a lot of technicalities around the status of Rastafari at that time.
Yeah.
And therefore it was difficult. I kind of talked about notions of cultural citizenship and trying to engage culturally with the wider community in the face of a lack of legally defined citizenship rights. And, you know, in Ethiopia, you can only hold one passport. You can't have multiple passports. And so, you know, but that is not accessible to people who are not Ethiopian, you know, so technically under the law, regardless of how much one might see themselves and self-define themselves as Ethiopian. Now, in 2017, however, there was an opening in terms of residence permits being allowed for Rastafari. And this I kind of, when I was writing the book, in addition to this sort of cultural citizenship, I was also looking at how Rastafari was strategizing as a means of kind of entering into a definition under Ethiopian law, for instance, identifying as a specific ethnic group. Mm-hmm. And this has happened in other parts of Ethiopian society where specific ethnic groups have applied to be defined as such under the Ethiopian constitution. And this was something that was spoken to me by some Rastafari as a way of engaging with the Ethiopian state. However, that particular one, it doesn't really work when you have a bunch of white people, or, you know, or just generally non-Black people, as the mayor of Shashamani sort of said to me, like, you know, these people that look like, because I'm a white person, you know, he said, these people that look like you, like, isn't your homeland Europe? Like, why would you come here? You know, and the Rastafari speak about colonialism. Why bring the colonial masters with you? You know, like, that was one of the things that the mayor of Shashamani at the time said to me. So these are there were these strategies to gain some level of acceptance and integration. But then in 2017, the residency was put into play. However, even though, and I'm just reading from my most recent essay, Rastafari repatriates alongside foreign contributors to the development of Ethiopia and Ethio-Israelis, they were afforded residency in the country. Identification cards would provide legal legitimacy for Rastafari repatriates, but it was clear that this would not mean that Rastafari would be considered Ethiopian citizens. And thousands of people will be issued the new identity cards, but they still cannot take part in elections or engage in the country's security and defense sectors. So this is a significant development, but if the goal is citizenship, if the goal is full acceptance, it still remains necessary to engage with the narrative of Ethiopian-ness in order to have that sense of integration within the society.
Amazing. Well, that's one of my favorite things about asking people with books that have, you know, a couple years have passed since they came out, like, what is worth revisiting about your own work? And I'm really delighted that you have, you know, continued to think about this stuff and to follow the history and the story. Like, how much do you continue to read about these issues and study them, even though you're kind of removed from the world of higher education at this point? Are you still pretty engaged in this?
I think that what I gained from doing this work was a kind of sense of the different dynamics around nation, nationality, citizenship, and identity, which I think are essential to what I do as a teacher, even of sort of literature, communication, critical thinking, et cetera, in a space where notions of belonging are consistently fraught. And so I have continued to read around this because, in addition to the tremendous amount of learning from the experience of Ethiopians and Rastafari, especially within the space of Shashamani, it has given me insight into the space of Montreal, for instance, and a lot of the theoretical ideas that stemmed from the conversations that I was lucky enough to have with people in Shashamani and in Ethiopia in general, and then through my postdoc in Kingston, Jamaica, it has led to, you know, significant thinking around the way that the Quebec government is presently engaging in what can only be referred to as populist divisive tactics to make certain people feel less a part of the society in which I live.
Well, Dr. Aaron McLeod, I have absolutely loved revisiting your book with you, Visions of Zion, Ethiopians and Rastafari and the Search for the Promised Land from NYU Press. Do you have any places where listeners out there who might be interested in following your work, where they might be able to do so, to find you, to follow you, et cetera?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm the Touch of All Right, which people ask me what that is. It's something that my grandmother, my Irish grandmother, used to say, which was, well, that's a little touch of all right. And so there's already a couple Erin McLeods out there. So I'm Touch of All Right, TouchofAllright. I have my website, which is Erin McLeod, and that's ErinMacLeod.ca. I'm working on some new projects, some new writing projects, playing around with kind of these notions of identity and narrative, one of which has to do with following the narrative of my grandfather, who was killed in on January 14th, 1945, as a bomber pilot. So over Germany. So looking at all of the dynamics around Bomber Command, as well as who he was, how I learned about him, how his life completely changed the trajectory of my father's life, and expanding that to sort of these ideas of how does one think of themselves as Canadian, and what does this mean in the context of the kind of complicated, difficult, and very problematic narratives around Canada at war. So that's another project that I'm working on right now.
I love it. Well, Dr. Erin McLeod, thank you so much for joining me. This has been a wonderful conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I am always happy to talk about Ethiopia to anybody, really.